Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 835th episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work together to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution. In today's episode, we have the replay of our August Rosie on the House radio show from Phoenix, Arizona. The guest is me talking about creating wild landscapes. Enjoy.
Rosie on the House, every Arizona homeowner's best friend.
Come on around back Arizona, Saturday morning, 8 o'clock, the outdoor living hour of Rosie on the House, your Saturday morning tradition since 1988. 8 o'clock hour, our outdoor living hour, fourth Saturday of the month. Can you believe we're almost through August already? And Farmer Greg's joining us in studio for the Urban Farming Hour and talking growing wild food. Good morning, Farmer Greg. Wild food, are we talking like deer meat, deer berries, or forage foods?
No, not forage. This is in the city. And really what we're talking about is setting up our landscape such that food just grows. You know, it never made sense to me that people would plant and nurture plants that don't make food. And so over the course of the past 30 plus years, I've figured out how to landscape with food so that there's always just food growing there.
This kind of brings out your lazy gardener, you like to say.
Yeah, it does. Basically, the concept is set it and forget it. You just set it in motion and forget it. Now, the setting it in motion is a process. And so I was at the urban farm for 32 years, and every year we would just have dozens of different things that would come up year after year on the property. And we've been here a little over 2 years now on our new farm. And magically, the systems that I started putting in place when we first arrived started producing food last year.
So let's go through some of those. Am I jumping ahead too quick?
No, I think we're good. For here, things like oregano and basil, herbs, you've heard me say this before, the easiest thing to grow and the most expensive thing to buy are herbs. And so this year we had cilantro, oregano, and basil come up from plants or seeds that we had from last year.
Seasonings I use regularly.
Right, exactly. Interestingly, last year, I think you remember, I planted 160 fruit trees last summer. And when I was planting those fruit trees, I was using the worm castings that I had been making over the previous year. Worm castings are worm poop, and basically all the scraps from the kitchen go into the worm bin, and the worms eat them and give us a nice fertilizer. So I was taking a handful of those worm castings and putting them in each hole as I planted. So last summer, we ended up with over 30 different tomato plants growing in our orchard. So that's a wild plant.
And now, before we get too far past the worm castings, one thing I love to bring up, because it's one thing that has always drives me nuts, is the amount of packaging that we go through. And I try to never order anything online, but the amount of cardboard that is just consumed and thrown away. And when you had Arizona Worm Farm on the broadcast, I think has it already been one full year or two?
It's been two.
2 years. Wow.
Time flies, man.
Yeah, oh, man, does it. But he uses all the cardboard for packaging that was received, not only like from a delivery truck, but if you have any kind of cardboard food packaging, cardboard, he said, is great worm food as well. So he composts all that cardboard that otherwise just, if you've ever gone to the transfer station here in North Phoenix, there is a whole room, probably 30 feet tall, piled to the top with nothing but cardboard, and they've got nowhere to put it.
Wow. Yeah. So what I actually did at Zach's prompting is I bought a 16 sheet shredder. You just go online or buy locally. So it takes up to 16 sheets of paper. Guess what else it takes? So I run all my cardboard boxes through there, and that's the carbon part of the worm bin. So for every bucket of kitchen scraps that I put in the worm bin, I'm adding twice as many cardboard.
So you're turning something that you would have otherwise thrown away into part of your food production.
Yeah, exactly. When thank you, Zach. He suggested that. And so there you have it.
Worm castings. It's kind of like gardener's gold.
Not kind of like. It is gardener's gold, man. It is the good stuff. So and the thing about composting with worms is it doesn't get hot. So any of the seeds that end up, melon seeds, carrot seeds, tomato seeds, pepper seeds, any of those seeds that end up in the worm bin, there isn't heat there to kill them. So that's going to transfer into your garden space.
That's cool.
Right? So that's how the tomatoes got into my orchard. And I call this wild food because I didn't purposely plant it. That's really the definition of it, is setting up systems in your yard so that they just self-propel moving forward. So it's not something that you have to consciously think about every year. And it takes a few years to get those systems in place. And I learned a lot of those systems in this whole notion of permaculture, which I like to call the art and science of working in the flow of nature. And once those systems are in place, really your job becomes harvesting food.
Also understanding that what happens this year may not happen next year. Some things are in cycles. Not everything's annual. You may have ended up with a great natural growth of tomatoes this year and maybe not so great next year. Or who knows, yep. It could be even better than next year. Why is it so much better this year than last year? Who knows? But nothing is ever going to be exactly the same as it was before. And I see so many people spending so much time fretting over that. Do I need to add more fertilizer? Do I need this? Do I need that? It's going to change a little bit every year. The plant's not going to do the exact same thing every single year. It's impossible. It's a plant. It lives in nature and the weather, and the weather's not the same.
Exactly. And it's not in rows.
Right.
You have to remember that. This isn't perfect rows. This is like walking in the forest. So at the urban farm, the house that I lived at for 32 years, we had what was called an old growth food forest. And I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, there were dozens of things that would come back year after year. And it just made life easy because we're just letting nature do what nature does. So the carrots would go to seed. I had a reporter at the house. I remember this. I had a reporter at the house one day, and I had some carrots that had gone to seed. And they're beautiful flowers that then put out couple hundred seeds per flower. And she said, how do you save those? And I grabbed it, I crunched it in my hand, and I threw it out into the yard.
That's it. Let nature do its thing.
Yeah.
So obviously having the right soil conditions for that, you're back to your worm castings and you're prepping and why it takes a few years.
Exactly. So there's also a notion, and we may have talked about this in the Wayback Machine here on the show. There's this notion of regenerative. Nature creates regenerative systems. Regenerative systems are systems that recreate themselves over and over again without our help. It's like this circular system. Humans have created only degenerative systems that don't self-perpetuate. And when I'm looking at my yard, I'm looking to see what kind of regenerative systems can I put in place? What kind of things can I do to build future food into the landscape? And a big one of those is the kind of seeds that I plant. There are three kinds of seeds. Likely our listeners have heard of them. Those genetically modified. The good news is mostly genetically modified seeds aren't available for our gardens. So that's not something we have to worry about. And they're hybrid seeds. Hybrid seeds are they take watermelon A and watermelon B and they cross-pollinate them naturally, and that makes watermelon C, which is seedless and really sweet. I think they call them sugar babies or something like that. The problem with it is if there are seeds in it, then those seeds...
They're sterile.
No, they're not necessarily sterile, but they're a mixture of the mom and the dad. So when you plant them, you're not necessarily going to get the same quality of watermelon out of that seed. It might be a little worse. It might be a little bit better. What happens is the genetics start diversifying. Let me put it that way. Now, I've planted hybrid seeds before. There's nothing wrong with planting hybrid seeds. But one of the big things that I do is I use what's called an open pollinated seed or heirloom seeds. It's all the seeds that we have at the Great American Seed Up every year are open pollinated. And what open pollinated means is that if you plant that seed, it is genetically stable enough that it creates a duplicate of the parent, a duplicate of what it came from. So what I did for 32 years at Urban Farm in Phoenix, and what I'm doing here now, is I'm only planting open pollinated seeds. And what's happening is they'll go to seed, they'll self-spread, and they'll come up. One day I was at the Urban Farm. I was taking the dog for a walk in the neighborhood, and I walked down my driveway and out into the street, and there was a lettuce plant growing in the neighbor's yard.
From it's your like, seed?
From my seeds, exactly.
All right, exactly. Hang tight. More on growing wild food here in the Urban Farm Hour at Rosie on the House. Back after this.
Out where the wild things are.
Back in the Urban Farm with Farmer Greg talking about growing wild food. And one thing we didn't get to was layers. And I love this point of layering. It strikes me every time. It's so obvious, but not something that people take time to really plan out.
Yeah, plan out or think about. That's a really important piece of a forest. When you walk into a forest, you don't walk into plants all the same size. There's different layers. And in permaculture, we like to look at the different layers. And the overstory trees are the shade trees for us. In the backyard at the Urban Farm in Phoenix, there is a 60-foot tall ash tree. It's an Arizona ash. It was 60 foot tall when I moved in there in 1989. And I managed the height of that tree and managed the tree over the years. And it was a beautiful shade tree. It created nice shade for the house in the afternoon. It was right in the perfect spot. And every fall, it would dump all kinds of leaves on me for mulch. In fact, one of the interesting things was I had the neighbors trained. I had three different neighbors that would bring me their bags of leaves every fall because I was using them for the basins around the trees and in the compost piles. The value of an overstory tree is shade and mulch. And then underneath the overstory trees is the understory trees. Now, in our fruit tree program, we like to encourage people to keep their fruit trees small, or no more than about 8 or 10 feet tall, because a peach tree can get 30 feet tall, and a peach at the top of a 30-foot tall peach tree is bird food. So we like to encourage urban orcharding and keeping our trees small. So if you plant on the west side of your property, you plant shade trees. Mesquites are great. Palo Verdes are great. Ironwoods are great, by the way. They all produce a seed that is edible. So wild food, you can incorporate native wild foods in your landscape as well. That will provide shade. And all three of those trees are nitrogen fixers, so all the leaves, when they fall, have a little bit of nitrogen in them. And then there's the shrub layer. And any bushes that you have, there's the dwarf black mulberry that's a nice bush. And those are underneath. We keep them smaller, so you can harvest them on standing on the ground. Berry bushes are in the shrub layer. And then the next layer, number four, would be our veggie herb garden layer. They call it the herbaceous layer. And that's anywhere from ground to about 3 feet up. That's where our gardens are at. And then the next layer would be the root layer. And one of the things that I did a long time ago at the Urban Farm in Phoenix, Romy, was I planted sweet potatoes. And sweet potatoes, they do multiple cool things for us. First of all, they make sweet potatoes. You can actually harvest a nice amount of sweet potatoes out of your garden if you're growing them. Secondly, the leaves are edible of sweet potatoes. Third thing is, a layer of sweet potatoes on top of the ground is going to keep your ground temperatures 30 to 50 degrees cooler in the summertime. And if you're planting them in your orchard, you plant cowpeas. That's another thing we suggest, cowpeas or sweet potatoes. If you're planting them around the base of your trees, that is going to keep the ground temperatures around your trees cool enough that they actually might survive this insane heat.
With less water use too.
Exactly, with less water. And we're going to talk about mulch here in a little while, and that helps you use a lot less water as well. And then there's the vine layer. That's anything vining. Grapes are good for vines, or they just actually climb up. So those are the different layers of a food forest that you can integrate.
And that ash tree at the urban farm you're talking about, what kind of hit would that take to the urban farm if that tree ever went away and the elimination of the microclimates that tree provides? That would be pretty significant.
It would be pretty significant. Interestingly enough, and I didn't plant it, it just was there when I arrived. It was in the northwest corner of the house quadrant. So it was about 15 feet west of the house on the north side. And a 60-foot tall tree has a span of 40-foot diameter. So the nice thing about 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the urban farm, half the house would be in the shade. It's a huge shade maker, and that shade keeps the house cooler.
And shade, you mentioned don't plant anything you can't eat, but creating that shade, and we're going to get to it in a little bit, but it's like, don't plant anything you can't eat. Not necessarily anything you can't eat, but also anything that doesn't support edibles. Because there are non-edibles that really do help support the edibles. So in a sense, they are helping.
Yeah. We're going to talk about stacking functions in the next segment. And stacking functions is, we'll talk about it then, but it's a really cool concept in permaculture. And one of my favorite things.
That's here at Rosie on the House with Urban Farm Hour. Farmer Greg joining us. We're going to be talking about stacking functions. And also, I sidetracked you there, spent the whole segment talking about layers. But you wanted to hit districts or municipalities as well, what this could do for different city ordinances and HOAs, et cetera. So a lot here to cover still at Rosie on the House. Back after bottom of the hour news. Growing wild food is our topic here. We've been talking about different ways to set up your environment around your home, castle, or cabin in the landscape to create a soil condition and microclimates that helps you be conducive to growing wild food. But Farmer Greg, you had wanted to cover ordinances, and let's do that before we get any further ahead of it and of ourselves and the talking points.
So I grew a lot of food in the front yard at the urban farm. And my degrees, I got 2 degrees from Arizona State University, one in 2004 and one in 2006, all in urban planning. I was studying urban planning when I was at Arizona State University. And so I was very cognizant of how the neighborhood would be impacted by wild food growing in it. You know, because there's been people in the past that have gotten into it with municipalities about your front yard looks like not great, and we want it to look great, and all that kind of stuff. So I was very cognizant of how the front yard looked. And one of the things that I did in 2004, I actually put a citrus hedge right off of the street. Now, I couldn't build a fence on the front part of my property that was 6 feet tall, but I could plant trees. And I've seen people do this with oleanders as well. I can plant trees and use them as a hedge for privacy from the street. So I did that. And this is a concept in permaculture called edge. An edge means what can we do with the space along the edge of our property? Because a lot happens there. So I actually, in the front yard of the urban farm, was 80 feet wide and about 40 feet deep in the front. And I had 38 fruit trees in the front yard. And when you walked in, you walked into the front yard of the urban farm over there, you saw how open it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I was using those fruit trees. I had apples down the south side, along with peaches and grapes, citrus along the front and down the north side. And that created some nice privacy. But then I would also be cognizant of how they looked, so I wouldn't let them get out of control. I always managed the pruning on them nicely so they looked like a nicely pruned space. And the garden beds in the front yard, I always tended them a little more in the front yard than I did in the backyard. The backyard at the urban farm, that was free game for me just to let go wild. And it was really magical, some of the stuff that happened back there when I was doing that. So I just want to have everybody be cognizant that if you're going to do something like this in your front yard, you need to make sure that you're stepping inside of what's socially appropriate, culturally appropriate. Make sure that it looks nice. Another thing I would suggest that you do is grow food and share it with your neighbors. Be that guy or that gal that has food that you just take and share. And one of the things that everybody on the street at the urban farm, there were 22 houses on my street. From the time I started my fruit tree program in 1999 until I left, every single house on that street got fruit trees from me. It was standard operating procedure for me. If people lived on my street, they got fruit trees. I just gave them to them. And so really working with the neighbors makes sure that this process is something that they love.
And it's something, especially on the tree side, doesn't take, once you get the water system out there and the tree planted, you can go back to the urban farm archives. Farmer Greg goes into huge depth about creating that perfect tree hole and the soil conditions for it. Putting it in there, planting it, it's one of those things that takes the least amount of effort after established.
Yeah,
why there aren't more fruit trees and citrus, why they've been taken out and removed is beyond me, because they are one of the lowest maintenance and highest producing plants that we could put in our yards.
Yeah, big time. And there's so many cool different varieties of citrus. I have a book. It's called The Citrus Industry. It came out in 1967, I believe. University of California, Davis put it out. And there are literally hundreds and hundreds of different varieties of citrus that have been grown on the planet that they documented in there. Unfortunately, we have one citrus grower in the state. And so we're limited to about 25 different varieties. But in those 25 different varieties, there are some amazing citrus fruit. The front hedge at the urban farm had a dozen navel oranges in it. And you remember me and navel oranges, right? I love, 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 love navel oranges. And I ate most of them myself when I lived at the urban farm.
Well, when you're talking the front hedge, you know, this isn't walking into an orchard. This you kept fence high. So it wasn't, you know, we're not talking about massive citrus trees that you can see around town in the old groves that are hundreds of pounds.
This was like a fence that was 4 feet wide and about 9 feet tall from street level, just like that. And I kept them pruned to that size, and they just made a delightful amount of fruit for me from November into April. So the big thing with setting your yard up for wild food is to go out and observe. I have said for years, you all have heard me say this before, spend at least a year on a property before you make any major changes. And I had to move to a new property to really take that to heart. I waited a year before we made any major changes. And there are still things that I would do differently. So observation is the number one thing to be looking for. Just pay attention to where the sun is at. It's called solar aspect. In the winter, the sun is lower in the sky. In the summer, it's higher in the sky. What parts of your property are getting more sun or less sun? And this is going to lead to different microclimates. If you have a backyard with block walls and gravel, that is going to be a much hotter microclimate than a backyard with a wooden fence and grass.
That's where you set up your solar oven.
Yeah, exactly.
Against the block wall and the quarter minus granite.
I have, you know, this. We're getting ready to start our fall tree classes. We offer all kinds of free tree classes every fall. And if you go to fruittrees.org, you can sign up for them for free. My second class that I give is three ways to kill your fruit trees. Because every year, invariably, I get people sending me pictures or I see them on Facebook, and they're doing things that aren't setting the trees up for success. So I got all kinds of pictures and all kinds of information on how to really set your trees up for success. And we're looking to make those microclimates in your yard cooler. And so if you do have gravel and block, I have solutions for you. It's not a bad thing. It's just we need to address it. So you're observing for those microclimates. You're observing for where the water's at. We all have roofs, and when it rains, we get about 7-8 inches of rain a year in the valley. When it rains, you want to be managing that water into your landscape such that it gets used. One of the things that was crazy, my parents bought a house in Prescott maybe 2 decades ago, and the entire development was set up to run all of the rainwater that fell on their property out into the streets and into the gullies. And I looked at that and I just shook my head, because they were guttering the houses and running the gutters to the streets. And it just made no sense to me. You could actually set up landscapes that would take all that water and use it, especially, we have to do that, especially in the desert. That's really important. So pay attention to where your water is. And there's multiple places for water to come from. Now, granted, I had flood irrigation at the urban farm. There are people doing what I did in Phoenix on not flood irrigated lots. So with city water and rainwater. So there's flood irrigation. There's city water. You may be on a well, depending on where you're at. There's condensation water that comes off of your air conditioning unit. There's a crazy amount, especially this time of year, a crazy amount of water that comes from condensation water. So start paying attention to where your water comes from and how to utilize it better. In 2014, it was September 14th, 2014, we had a 3-hour rainstorm that dumped 3 inches of rain at the urban farm. And I don't know if you remember it, but there were underpasses flooded. There was a lot of flooding in the city from that. And in that 3-hour period, we got about 29,000 gallons of water that fell on the urban farm. And it all got soaked up because I'd been working on the soil and mulching and getting that soil ready to receive that water. So that's another thing to observe for, especially in the desert.
That water event, was that the time when Skunk Creek backed up on 17 and started flooding 17 in the southbound lane? That I distinctly remember. Was that it?
That's the one.
Oh, man, that was a lot of rain at one time.
Yeah, that was a lot of rain at one time. So these are all things that I want you to observe for and pay attention to in your space, because that's going to inform you how to be a better gardener, permaculturist, farmer of your space, so that you're working in those flows and not against them.
And just like Farmer Greg outed himself here that he would still do things different, you could probably spend 2, 3, 4, 5 years observing and still not get it all right, because by the time you start implementing things, that will change what you've observed previously, because you've got a new element to your environment. And the more you add, the more it's going to change. So you can't beat yourself up or use that as an excuse not to get started because you want it to be perfect. It's never going to be quote unquote perfect. What is that perfect? It doesn't exist in the sense of layout. It's what you produce. That's where you're judging your perfection.
Exactly. And after 32 years at the urban farm, I was still learning and still changing and still doing things different and still observing.
Still learning. And we're still here learning, and we're sharing everything that Farmer Greg has learned over his years as an urban farmer. We've got one final segment right after this. All right, before we get to your final talking points, Farmer Greg here in the Urban Farm Hour, I wanted to talk about the PDC, Permacultural Design course, that you guys offer. We ended that last segment talking about the design work, and that's what these courses are designed to do, help you create that permacultural design for your home.
Yeah, well, that and to understand what permaculture is. So I did my first permaculture design course in 1991. It's a 72-hour in-person course that I did out in Carefree, actually, and it transformed my life, and it really did a deep dive into what permaculture is and how to apply it. And since 2006, Don Titmus and I have been offering a permaculture design course in Phoenix. We do it every spring. So it'll be in February, March, and April of 2025. And it'll change it flat out. It'll change your life forever. If you jump into the course, provides a look at natural systems that we don't get anyplace else.
And you can go ahead and reserve your seat for that course now.
Yeah, it is. It is open. You go to urbanfarm.org/PDC, and the information's there.
And you'll get to learn more about stuff like stacking functions.
Oh, my gosh. Stacking functions is absolutely my favorite. As an undergraduate student at Arizona State University, this was in 2001. Now, remember, I did my permaculture design course in 1991, where I learned about stacking functions. So fast forward a decade, and I'm in my transportation planning class at Arizona State University. And this professor starts talking about trip stacking. And it's like, oh, what's that? You leave your home, you go to the market, you go to the vet, you go to the drugstore, you go to the farmer's market, then you come home, rather than doing each individual one and coming home. And so that's basically what stacking functions in permaculture is. We look at all the resources that we have and figure out how many times can we use it, or how many things does it do for us. And one of my favorite things to talk about stacking functions around is chickens. I am a huge, huge believer that if you have a backyard space, you need to have chickens in it. Chickens give us chicken poop that makes great fertilizer. They dig. They're great tillers. They eat bugs. They eat weeds. When you hand raise them, they make great pets. And hens, and that's all I'm suggesting you get is hens. Hens produce eggs most every day. You guys have chickens, don't you, Romy?
We do. And a lot of municipalities won't allow you to have a rooster in the yard, but they will. I don't know any that completely restrict chickens. I think the last two were Glendale and Chandler, and those both recently flipped to allow you to have backyard chickens.
Oh, really?
But no roosters.
I knew Chandler because a buddy of mine rode the mayor of Chandler until they got that change. I didn't realize Glendale had changed it.
You know, last time we had mentioned it, we did get a note from somebody that said that's been changed there too. I'll double confirm.
Excellent. Well, they make great backyard pets, and they leave you a nice egg deposit almost every day.
And you said great pets if you hand raise them, but in addition to that is the entertainment value.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, absolutely. So stacking functions is we have a hen, and that hen does multiple things for us. So really what we're doing with stacking functions is we're looking at the different assets that we're using in our yards, the workers in our yards. See, in this case, from a permaculture perspective, that chicken is a worker in our yard, and seeing how many times we can have them work for us. So that's what stacking functions is. It's one of my favorite permaculture concepts.
There's so many ways we use chickens as well. And even at the point where they're not layers, they still have function for us. They're big, old enough, and forage experienced enough, you don't need to feed them. They know where to go for water. They know where to go for food. And they just live in the orchard as our insect control.
Yeah, exactly. Makes a huge difference. So
there are many, many functions.
Right, exactly. You know, my biggest takeaway for people from this segment is observe your yard, pay attention to what's going on in the space. Don't plant things you can't eat or that don't support edibles. In fact, I've had, I think her name is Lisa Zimmerman. I've had her on the podcast multiple times, and she always says plant at least 20% of your yard with pollinators, with flowers. And you know what make one of the best pollinators, Romy?
Weeds.
Oregano.
Oh.
Basil. Cilantro. It's amazing when they're in full bloom to watch the hundreds of pollinators that are on them.
That goes back to where you started the hour with, is that your herbs are the easiest to grow and most expensive at a grocery store.
Yep, exactly.
So start with your herbs, and that's a pollinator as well. And as we wrap up the final minute here, I know we didn't get to a lot of talking points, but a new function with Rosie on the house, when you go to the podcast page, the Urban Farm breadcrumb, you can click on that, and all of Farmer Greg's individual hours come up. So then you could go pick which hour you're looking for, whether it's growing wild food and just going back over the year what we talked about, extreme weather, tree weather care that we did with High Creations last month, gardening, getting your garden watered, and desert soil building. So all of those on the Urban Farm breadcrumb will help you find each individual hour with Farmer Greg.
Nice. And I'm really excited. Next month, we have Nika Forte from St. Vincent de Paul Urban Farm. She's going to be talking about planting your fall garden.
And it's been a little while since I've been to that urban farm, and it was amazing then. I can't wait to hear about what it is. I may have to schedule time to sneak down there and give myself a preview of it before we bring her in, because what they're doing is
magic.
Magic. That's perfect. Farmer Greg, we'll talk to you in September with St. Vincent de Paul.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent Van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.